Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up on the show, a look at the year in Utah news, a 2018 year in review. From the death of a church president in January to the Tribune's naming of Major Brent Taylor as Utah of the Year earlier this week. And joining me to talk about this fascinating and perhaps at times overwhelming year, we've got Salt Lake Tribune senior managing editor Matt Canham here. And Matt, thanks for making time for this.
Thank you.
We've also got managing editor David Noyce in studio with us. And Dave, thanks for being here as well.
Good morning.
And to round out the bunch, we've got Salt Lake Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke. And Robert, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you.
What were the most important stories of the year from your perspective? How about a pick for underplayed story of the year? You can let us know by calling 801-355-8255 or posting your questions and comments at sltrib.com on this week's Behind the Headlines page. Before we jump into the chronology of the year, I'd like to try something out. There are a lot of stories to dig through, but I'd like to hear from each of you what defined the year 2018 in the Utah news cycle. Was there a single event, a single theme maybe that you could point to and say that was 2018 in a nutshell? A pick for defining story just to kick things off. Maybe I'll start with Matt Canham, senior managing editor. What would that be for you?
I'll pick one that I know that my other two colleagues here are not going to pick and say the retirement of Senator Orrin Hatch after 42 years in the Senate, more than my entire lifetime. He has stepped away, and the repercussions of that, what the dominoes of that, we now have Mitt Romney as our senator-elect, probably the most high-profile individual senator in the country as a freshman. And so I think that's not only been a big story this year, but will be a big story next year as well.
All right. The retirement of Orrin Hatch from Matt Canham, and a 71-year-old freshman senator coming in the form of Mitt Romney. David Noyce, how about you for a pick for the story that defined, 2018?
I'll start with the story I started with when I wrote the year in review, which was the ballot measures that were voted on this year. It was sort of a year of voters taking charge, sort of sending a message to the legislature of let us do some of the lawmaking. It represented not only the fact that they passed at the ballot box, but also that you had to get thousands of signatures to even get on the ballot. Obviously, led by medical marijuana was probably the most talked about, but Medicaid expansion, something the legislature grappled with for years that Utahns fairly significantly supported. And then also the redistricting measure, all of those were very important and I think showed Utah voters sort of asserted themselves in different ways.
Trying to carve out a niche for themselves. And I don't know if that represented well, we'll talk about this more on the show in a little bit. But OK, that's David Noyce's pick. Robert Gerke, a defining thread of reporting for 2018.
Yeah, I would, echo what Dave said. I think these ballot initiatives were they drove so many other parts of the news cycle. They drove the church's involvement in the medical marijuana issue. They drove the they drove this debate over the Medicaid expansion. They drove a lot of people to the polls, and that in turn gave Ben McAdams a victory over Mia Love, which was one of the biggest congressional races we've had in this state in almost a decade. Mm-hmm. And so there was just so many ripples out of those ballot measures that I think it had a big impact in other areas, not just on those specific issues. And I also think that the change in church leadership that you mentioned at the beginning of the Mormon Church, I'm sorry, the LDS, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
You'll get it.
That's one of the changes.
I think President Nelson has made a mark on the church in his first year in a way that we really haven't seen, that sort of those sorts of changes in a long time in the church leadership. And I think there's probably signals that there's going to be more to come.
And that is something that we'll dig into definitely during the show. And I want to actually circle back to the election and the function that this was an election year and the fact that it was as hard fought and contentious as it was. But I want to go back to the retirement of Orrin Hatch, because that kind of set the stage for this right. This election year. He announced in January that after 40 years in office, he would be retiring. And what that did was kick off speculation about Mitt Romney, as you said, Matt. And then, wasn't there a suggestion at the time that Mitt Romney or that there was a deal sort of to kind of convince Senator Hatch that now was the time to retire, to make room for Romney, and that, you know, you should make way for him, and that there was some sort of deal that was worked out. Does anybody remember this?
There absolutely was a deal worked out. It was interesting when Dan Jones passed away recently. Bob Henry, who was a longtime political advisor to Senator Hatch, told me about a meeting that he and Dan and Senator Hatch had, where they and some of Hatch's political team, where they went over the poll numbers, and you know, Dan Jones, in his typical Dan Jones fashion, laid them out pretty bluntly. I mean, Hatch could win. He wasn't terribly popular, but he would, you know, Warren was going to have to work hard at it. And, you know, they kind of discussed it. They kicked it around a little bit and came away with Warren saying, you know, I'm going to go talk to Mitt. And it wasn't that next day, but it was sometime early or late last fall, I guess, where Warren went and talked to Mitt. Mitt said, I want to chew it over a little bit. And then, you know, ultimately came back and said, you know, if you step aside, I'll do it. And then the rest is history, I guess. So, yeah, they orchestrated all of this well in advance.
40 years of Orenheim. I mean, there's going to be a Hatch Center here in Salt Lake City that the University of Utah will...
And an Orrin Hatch announce. Courthouse, most likely.
If we ever get the government open again, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then, yeah, as we said, you know, Romney will become a freshman senator at the age of 71. And it'll be interesting to see what the Romney era is in the Senate. We spent a lot of time on Senator Hatch this year. He was, in fact, the Tribune's Utah of the Year last year, I recall. Mm-hmm. But just speaking of retirements, or at least people who are stepping down from their current position, there were some other big name announcements on the political front earlier this year in terms of retirement. House Speaker Greg Hughes also in January said that he wouldn't be running for his seat again. And then so did eventually a full 1/5 of the Utah State Legislature. Why all of these departures? And Gerke, do you want to try and tackle that?
Well, I think Hughes had made it known for a while that he wasn't – traditionally, speakers only serve two terms, and he probably could have been elected to a third term. But he had kind of made it known for a while that he wasn't going to do that. And it's not – once you've been speaker, it's kind of hard to go back to being a ordinary member. So I think it's not surprising that he got out. Senate President Wayne Niederhauser left, so we have new legislative leadership in both chambers. And then all of these members, you know, jumped out. I was a little surprised to see that, and I don't know if we can point to a specific trend or one factor that drove a lot of them. A lot of them were senior members, and some of them, you know, just had other opportunities, were moving out of state. But there was a confluence of events for whatever reason that we saw this pretty substantial turnover in the legislature this year, and it's going to mean some new faces. Taylor Stevens did a really nice story the other day about the new number of new women coming into the legislature, and it's going to be a record high in terms of the female membership of the legislature. And I think that's a good thing. I think it changes the way the legislature works. It changes the whole feeling and the atmosphere at the Capitol.
I want to remind listeners to join us. If I said to you 2018 was the year of blank, what would you put in that blank and why? You can call us up and answer that question. 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. I want to just keep pushing us forward through this tumultuous year. Jumping back to the chronology of news, if we go forward, and Dave, to February, we arrive at the mass shooting of that took place at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. A national tragedy, but then there was the pretty immediate response from the survivors of that shooting, and then the launch of a nationwide youth movement, the Never Again movement, or March for Our Lives. And Utah saw a lot of that activism, right?
Yeah, in March, there were actually two pretty significant things that happened. One of them was a walkout at schools. We were on the ground at several of the schools, including one in Saratoga Springs. And it was interesting because this is obviously a very red state, very conservative, very Second Amendment loving state, I think it would be safe to say. But students are... They're in the line of fire, so to speak, and they feel that when they go in the classroom. It was stark to hear students say the first thing they look for now when they go to school is probably not whether they have homework waiting for them on the board, but what's a safe way to get out? Where should I go? That's sad. And students were fed up, and so they staged a walkout. Thousands of students did that. And then followed that up a couple of weeks later with a rally and march to the Capitol.
8,000 people made that march to the Capitol. And then they were confronted there by counter-protesters who were carrying guns.
They were. There was never any kind of skirmish, I guess you could say, but there were some things shouted across the lines to each side, both touting, you know, displaying their First Amendment rights, essentially. But although the counter protest was much, much smaller, there were still hundreds of people in the counter protest. So
there was at the time this, you know, not just in Utah, it was around the country. There was this palpable sense of change being possible that was in the air, and I'm wondering. Is it still? And that might be a question for Gerke.
As we so often see with these mass shootings, there's in the immediate aftermath a lot of concern and talk, and then there's not much action, either at the federal level or particularly at the state level. So one of the things that there has been some discussion of in the upcoming legislative session is red flag laws that other states have adopted. There's going to be another push to do that. There was a push late in the session last year, and these are bills or laws that would allow people who are a threat to themselves or to others for somebody to go into court and have their get an order to have their guns to force them to surrender their guns. And that helps more than with the mass shootings that we're talking about, but also it's helped with suicide in other states. Connecticut was one of the first to enact these, and they saw a significant reduction. I believe it was 25% reduction in their suicides by gun. There's some talk of that. That came out of a suicide task force, and there are a couple other bills that they're talking about. But in terms of actually addressing the issue head on, there really hasn't been an attempt to do that. There is going to be a bill this year that Andrew Stoddard, a new representative, is sponsoring he's calling it Lauren's Law after Lauren McCluskey, who we'll probably talk about later, the University of Utah student who was shot. That would enhance a penalty for somebody, or enact a penalty, I guess I should say, for somebody who loans their gun to somebody who then commits a crime with it. So there's nibbling around the edges, but there's not much to address the issue head on. There is one more bill, Carrie Ann Lisenby, I don't think it's Lisenby. I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the name now. Is sponsoring to study the causes and the root causes of mass violence like that, because there hasn't been a lot of good research done on the topic of what motivates these people to do what they do.
Yeah, and looking beyond the guns, but at the motives, the action of the act at the actors.
Yeah, what are the underlying causes?
Matt Canham, any thoughts on the Never Again movement and the tragedy that was. The tragedy that occurred, and then what was born out of it, this sort of movement that was born out of the tragedy at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School.
You saw a lot of activism, and one thing that did happen was, this was near our legislative session, at the end they created a kind of informal school safety commission that was supposed to come up with ideas to help make sure we don't have a mass shooting in a school here. It was informal. They had few meetings. But they did come up with some recommendations that the school board is trying to push kind of independently of the legislature. So though it's possible some of those would get there, about how we protect students at schools. This is making sure that everyone funnels through one door so you can protect one door in and out. There was even one school that had this big metal gate that closed, and there's a company trying to push these things. I think it's going to be an issue that doesn't go away. That there was this moment where people thought we should take action. That shooting of that school was so horrendous. But there is still the political wall up of what action is even palatable for, you know, getting enough votes to actually pass.
I'm realizing that we're never going to get through the year the way that we're going here. There's still quite a lot to get through.
Let's everybody talk fast.
Yeah, everybody speak faster. Just before we go to our first break, there were some high-profile obituaries this year, as we mentioned at the outset. And early in 2018, Dave, as you wrote in your column, not your column, in your article, the compilation of news from 2018, the death of the president and prophet of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. This is Thomas S. Monson. President Monson was succeeded by Russell M. Nelson, and we'll get to the stories surrounding his tenure a little bit later in the show, I hope. But just on Thomas Monson, his death in that moment, it wasn't exactly unexpected. He had been ill for quite a while, right?
Right, he'd been frail, and the church had acknowledged several years earlier that he was not attending meetings. He was not able to do that. He was not appearing at General Conference, let alone speaking at it. So very beloved, but probably a good significant chunk of his almost decade tenure, he was not able to function as he normally would have. So it was not exactly surprising. He died just 2 days into the year,
right.
So on January 2nd, succeeded by an even older gentleman, but in much better health.
Yeah, and that's Russell M. Nelson. I want to get to one other. This is a month later. It was John Huntsman Sr. who died, the billionaire chemical magnate and philanthropist and a member of an old guard of Utah movers and shakers. Matt Canham, Huntsman had an outsized influence in the state of Utah and beyond the borders of the state.
He is a big personality, and he's a man, force of nature, who created a fortune and used it in ways that not very many rich people do. He tried to create a business school at Utah State University when they really didn't have much of a named business school. He created his own cancer institute and had the goal of eradicating all cancers. He was not afraid to aim big. And that made him very unique in Utah as well as in the nation. He was one of the first billionaires to give away $1 billion, something that doesn't happen a lot. So he was a big personality, and he was a big figure in our state. And we should also know that he was the father of our current owner, Paul Huntsman, who's owned the paper for the last 2 years. Yeah. So John Huntsman was a very, very unique character.
Well, and also the father of the current U.S. ambassador to Russia, John Huntsman Jr. 2018 was obviously not a light news year, and we will see how much of it we can get to. But first, we need to head to a break. And we would still love to hear your picks for underplayed story of the year or for the story that defined 2018. Join us by calling 801-355-TALK. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham, Managing Editor David Noyce, and news columnist Robert Gerke. We're doing a 2018 year in review for this last Friday of the year, and you can join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255, or you can post them at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. Before we went to the break, we were talking about some notable Utahns who passed away over the course of the year. One Utahn who died in tragic circumstances was picked by Tribune as Utahn of the Year. And David Noyce, we're talking about North Ogden Mayor and National Guardsman Brent Taylor. Tell us about why he was picked as Utahn of the Year.
We had a lot of good choices we could have made this year, but this, I think, is the first time in memory that that readers agreed with us on the choice. Brent Taylor, first of all, he had been not many North Ogden mayors make a lot of news in the Salt Lake Tribune, but he was making it even before his death. Of course, he had been elected twice as North Ogden mayor, and he sort of burst onto the scene for most of our readers when he became involved in UTA, was appointed as a board member, and was really bent on reforming that agency, which has already been identified in numerous audits as needing reform. And he set about to do that and encountered a lot of opposition from sort of the entrenched people at the UTA. So he was already making news in that sense.
Right.
And then, of course, he was, of course, killed in Afghanistan in a kind of insider attack there.
Yeah, and as you said, he was someone who made news before that and was a reformer on the UTA board. Maybe I'll turn this to Robert or Matt, a legacy that Major Brent Taylor of the Utah National Guard, who was also the mayor of North Ogden, had. He focused on service. He talked about, one of his final Facebook videos was about getting out the vote.
Yeah, I think he's an incredibly admirable individual. He was a true believer in our country and the role that the National Guard played in Afghanistan. He had a lot of Facebook posts that not only were complimentary towards the soldiers that he fought alongside from our country, but also he talked quite highly of his Afghan colleagues, one of which wrote his wife a letter, which was really really powerful, about how Brent changed how this individual interacted with his daughter and his wife, saw them as not material objects, but as human beings, changed his whole worldview. And I think it's just that part was incredibly nice. In such a tumultuous political year, it felt like someone who represented everybody in the way that we've seen throughout our lives, political figures who can rise above the partisan sniping to get to the kind of core of who we are. He was a great representative of that.
Robert Gerke, on the legacy of Major Brent Taylor.
Well, yeah, I think Matt hit it on the head. I mean, he was universally beloved. Everybody who knew him, you know, talked very highly of this guy.
The Democrats in his city sent us notes about how much they loved working with him.
Yeah, and the sky was the limit for this guy politically, if he he was, could, you know, potentially have been one of those transformational figures, and his loss was, you know, tragic, and hopefully inspired others to sort of, you know, aspire to live a life that he would have, you know, that he modeled for people. Yeah. So his wife's demeanor and her behavior after his death has been, I think, inspirational, and she's been very strong, but also encouraged others to sort of pick up the flag and do what Brent would have done, I think. And so, you know, I think in a year where we had a lot of big names and prominent people pass away, somebody who maybe wasn't as prominent, I think, was Utahn of the Year, just because he sort of eclipsed that in such a major way.
Dave, just on the topic of Utahn of the Year, was it who else was being considered? Was it when the editorial board is making their decision about this, and the readers are weighing in? How is that process decided?
Rock, paper, scissors. It's not. We nominate, I guess you could say, about 20, including Mr. Murder Bridges.
The famous Bobcat.
Exactly. That we think should be considered, at least. Donovan Mitchell was high on the list, I think, in our discussions. Obviously, the Utah voters, we talked about that a little bit today, were high on our list. Prop 2 representatives. All of those, you know, certainly were considered.
Yeah. A public vote I'm also looking at here also pointed to a firefighter who was killed in wildfires in California.
Matthew Burchett.
He was somebody that I knew growing up. He was a big-hearted guy. Another fallen hero who leaves behind people who loved him. And there was also another first responder death that you highlighted who could have been Utahn of the Year, as I recall.
David Romrell, I believe, the South Salt Lake police officer, the first police officer in South Salt Lake's history that's been killed in the line of duty.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we expect a lot from people who go and do dangerous jobs every day. Mm-hmm. I think we should actually bring up one more obituary, although I'm sure that we've all lost people over the year. But one that was also shocking and tragic was the death of a University of Utah student. This is Lauren McCluskey. David Noyce, can you tell us about who McCluskey was?
Student athlete at the University of Utah. A heptathlete, so track, field, number of disciplines that she would work on. A very driven, goal-oriented student. She unfortunately got involved with a person briefly for about a month, a person who sort of lied about his past and that he was on parole, a sex offender, those different things. When she found out, she, of course, tried to get police to help, fearing for her life, I guess you could say, and talking to police repeatedly. We'll probably talk a little about those investigations. Anyway, she was tragically killed about almost a year to the day before since another killing on campus, which was much more random, of course. But
yeah. Well, I mean, let's get to the review, because her death did lead to this review by the University of Utah, where the university found faults. They saw that there were problems, but they said that nothing could have been done to prevent her death in their findings. And that was Matt Cannon. That stirred some controversy here, obviously.
Right, because it's the kind of statement you're not supposed to make because you can't back it up. You can't prove it one way or the other. You can point out where investigations could have been done better or were done correctly. But to say that something would change the outcome of a death like that, I think, was an insensitive comment, personally. To kind of help our listeners understand what happened here is, so Lauren tried to break up with Melvin Rowland, who was the person who ended up taking her life, and he would call and harass her. He'd show up at her apartment. He threatened to extort her by releasing images that she didn't want released. He told people who were her friends that he might have a gun. She made multiple phone calls. An investigation was not started promptly. And no one ever checked what his parole status was. Salt Lake City dispatchers just kept telling her to keep calling the university police, even though they weren't responding. She did everything she was supposed to do. And it's heartbreaking to think that a talented, smart young woman who had a whole life ahead of her did everything she, you know, should have done, and it wasn't enough, that people didn't take it seriously. Now, could it have stopped it? Maybe. But we would have loved to have known. And I think that if you are a student on campus or a parent of a student on campus, you want to know that police department is doing everything they can to take something like this seriously.
There have been changes instituted, though, at the University of Utah.
There's been talk of more training. There's not no discipline for any of the officers involved or the staff involved. There's talk of how to train better talk of trying to get more resources for this department. One of the reviews said this is a police department that is understaffed. And so there'll be an effort from the University of Utah at the legislature to get more police officers and victim advocates.
Here we are trying to squeeze a year into an hour, and so we're going to have to unceremoniously leave this tragic news. I mean, there's actually an article by Nate Carlisle in today's paper that digs into the lives of many notable Utahns who died this year. You can check that out at sltrib.com. But I am going to move us on and back into the realm of politics now. We kind of dipped into politics with the retirements that we were discussing earlier, but we hardly talked about the election in a substantial way. So we've got ballot propositions, and as at the outset, a couple of you said this was kind of the year of the ballot initiative. Medical marijuana, Medicaid expansion, independent redistricting, all of those passed. Was this, in essence, about lawmakers taking matters into their own hands? Voters taking it into their own hands.
Well, and I think to sort of lay the groundwork for it, we hardly ever see ballot initiatives in this state because it's so hard. The legislature's made it so incredibly hard to get one of these measures on the ballot because they don't want to be California where the people are always gathering signatures for, you know, dozens or scores of ballot measures. So they've made it incredibly hard to do and easy to get them knocked off. And yet this year, in an unprecedented way, we saw the voters kind of, as you said, taking matters into their own hands because of a pent-up frustration with the legislature's inaction on these key issues. And as you mentioned, medical marijuana had been percolating for years at the legislature, and there just hadn't been substantial action on it. And Medicaid expansion had been, you know, put off for years and years. And finally, you know, the voters acted on that one. And then Proposition 4 was an interesting one because there hadn't been a ton of discussion about it. But leading up to the next census and the next reapportionment, it seemed like a good time to do that. I was a little dubious that that one was going to make it on the ballot, frankly, because it's not something the voters are necessarily passionate about. They haven't, there hasn't been an uproar or clamor for action on this. But it passed as well. And so it's a significant change. Now, what remains to be seen is in the coming months and years, we already saw medical marijuana get rolled back by a replacement bill that was negotiated by the legislature and the LDS Church and some of the advocates for the medical marijuana.
Right.
And they may try to undo some of the others in the coming months and years ahead.
Well, and this is the question is, I mean, people debate whether or not this is an undoing. It's definitely a modification of what came out of the initiative process. But so the aftermath of it getting on the ballot and then the deal that was struck before voters had weighed in was a sort of interesting way for lawmakers to wrest control back from the voter.
Yeah, I was struck that the medical marijuana initiative that passed that everyone had talked so much about the year lasted for 2 days before lawmakers came in with their own, as Robert mentioned, negotiated deal.
I think this story, I think Prop 2 was one story that I thought could have easily been involved in our U-turn of the year, because you take the advocates, these people who have health conditions, who fought for this for years, supported by outside groups that have a lot of money so they could help get all the, you know, signatures, get on the ballot. They didn't just make a normally sleepy midterm election year dynamic. They changed the behavior of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They got the church to say they are supportive of medical marijuana, that it had to be done this year. The church has been ignoring this issue or silently killing it for years. Suddenly, there was public pressure. These people brought it to bear. And I know there's a lot of people who are frustrated that the LDS Church got involved and changed the bill at the end. And they have a right to be, I think. I just think we shouldn't lose sight of how this group got the church to get to this point.
Yeah.
And it affected everything. I mean, the amount of people who voted for Prop 2 were more than voted for any other thing on the ballot.
Well, and Robert Gerke pointed out earlier that conceivably, and I don't know if you can definitively point to this, but that conceivably the election of Ben McAdams, which we'll talk about in
just a minute.
I don't think there's any
was
way
driven
to
by
argue
this as well.
It.
Huh?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because we saw Ben was trailing until these votes that came overwhelmingly in favor of Prop 2, the late votes, the very last day, and it pushed him ahead by 700. There's no way he would have won that election without Prop 2 being on the ballot. Ben had a few good tailwinds working for him, but Prop 2 was probably the biggest one, because not only, as Matt said, these advocates changed the church's position, they changed the behavior of voters across the state. And people were registering in record numbers, and they were turning out in record numbers for a midterm election, and they were voting for Prop 2 more than anything else on the ballot. So that it drove people to the polls. The other thing I would say about the church's involvement, I think had this compromise not come into being, Rocky Anderson is litigating over this because he says the compromise that they've come up with, I keep calling it a compromise, it wasn't really a compromise, but the bill that they came up with, he says, is completely unworkable and is going to scuttle medical marijuana in the state and make it impossible to enact. And he may be right about that, but had this bill not been put into place, I think Prop 2 would have failed, because I think, with a little more time, a lot more money, and a lot more pressure from the LDS Church, they could have killed that thing, because it did pass by a very narrow margin, and we saw the numbers going down precipitously once the church's involvement started. So I think, we've got a law in place now, and we'll wait and see how it gets implemented, and it'll probably require some tweaking, but at the very least, we've got it on the books that Utah is a state that allows medical marijuana going forward, and it's a matter of how we get there.
Yeah, I'm gonna march us forward, because we're still in the year. We're not getting through it. But another big election story that we were just talking about, the election of this is the 4th district. A Utah Republican loses a seat in Congress, and now the state has a lone Democrat in Washington, Ben McAdams. People were really dialed in to this race, and it could have gone either way. It was an extremely close outcome. In the end, we pointed just now to medical marijuana and the people who are coming out for that. How long? It hasn't been that long since we've had a Democrat in Washington, though.
No, Jim Matheson won his last race in 2012, so he was there until 2014.
Until 2014, and then he was done. Do we have a sense yet of where, McAdams will put his time and energy, either Canham or Gerke?
I think we'll be in campaigning. He won by 680 votes. That will be a hard seat to hold on to. It's going to be a very interesting year in Congress. We are in the middle of a partial government shutdown right now, which will likely last through the time where Ben McAdams takes his oath of office and takes that seat. Hmm. How this Congress interacts with this president when the Democrats now control the House will be interesting. There's a group of progressive Democrats who are elected who will want to pull the party to the left. Then you have people like Ben McAdams who will sit squarely in the center. If he's going to keep this seat, he has to be a moderate. I think he'll vote that way. He's already talked about voting that way. He's voted against Nancy Pelosi to be the speaker. So how he balances that, that will be hard. I think there are some Republicans who think there's a benefit in having a member of the majority party. So we'll see how they interact with him going forward.
I mean, again, this is the reality of being a Democrat from Utah and Washington. This is what Jim Matheson did as well. Mm-hmm. And although I have to admit that I'm a little bit jaded by the concept that he's already looking to the next election, and that's what I mean. It's a two year cycle, and this is just where we're
yeah. At. I mean, every congressperson, the day they're elected, they start raising money for the next one. I think what you'll see from him is he'll be very high profile. He'll be out in front of the cameras as much as he can be to sort of remind people, hey, here I am, and he'll be very focused on constituent relations and trying to remind people that he's there serving, because that's what you need when you come back around next time. And he's going to, there are already Republicans lining up to run against him.
Okay. We are running again up against a break in the show here, but another interesting election outcome happened in San Juan County. This is the San Juan County Commission is now majority Navajo, majority Democrat. But that didn't happen out of the blue. There was a bit of backstory to that. I don't know who wants to tackle this. Maybe David.
Well, federal court, of course, have ordered some redistricting there because the American Indian majority, barely a majority, but certainly a majority in San Juan County, had been essentially deprived of the representation that they should have. So Kenneth Maryboy and Willie Grayars were elected to the San Juan County Commission. Both Navajos, both Democrats, both monument supporters. So that will very much change the dynamic in San Juan. It'll be the first non-white majority county commission in Utah history.
Stark contrast to what we have seen in the past on the San Juan County Commission. I think it's an interesting story. You should check it out at sltrib.com. Unfortunately, we don't have time at the moment to dig really deeply into it. The Tribune's been covering it well all year. Check it out. It's time for another break. There's still more from this year's news coming up. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio. I am joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Canham, David Noyce, and Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup today, a recap of 2018, and you can join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255. I honestly cannot tell if we're doing the year justice or not. David Noyce, I said that we would circle back around to the changes that have come out or come about within the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We talked about the change at the helm after the death of Thomas S. Monson. And many of the changes that we will be talking about now have to do with or are the result of new leadership in the church. Can you tell us about the big shifts that occurred inside of the church this year, David?
There's a long list, and I won't bore you with all of them. There were big changes. Russell Nelson, now 94, took the helm in mid-January and almost immediately began making an impact. First of all, his very first public policy statement was in support of the Dreamers, which was interesting. He also spoke a little bit about guns and gun laws in an offhand remark in a fireside. But more formal changes took place also. Robert mentioned one of them, a program within the church of visiting members called Home and Visiting Teaching was done away with, replaced with something a little bit more nebulous, but called ministering. He announced 19 temples, which is the most I think that's ever been announced in 1 year, including firsts for India and Russia, which may still be decades off in Russia. They announced plans for a new hymn book. They're changing their meeting services from 3 hours to 2 hours.
How
he did away with priesthood quorums. He made 11-year-olds so that they could become deacons in the Aaronic priesthood. The list is long of changes that he announced that were announced under him.
Well, we're leaving one out, which is a change in just the nomenclature in what we are supposed to call the church.
By far the most talked about thing is how we're supposed to talk about the church. This is something that he had spoken about before when he was an apostle, a junior apostle at the time. And President Hinckley, who was the president of the church at the time, sort of tried to smooth that over a little bit, just saying he's glad people are talking about the church, in essence. But President Nelson said this was impressed upon him on it by in on his mind by God. In other words, he's touting it as a revelation that the church is supposed to stop using, and people are supposed to stop referring to the church and its members as Mormons or LDS.
Right, causing a lot of consternation for people in the news industry.
Yes.
I want to get, there's also quite a bit of talk about how bishop interviews, one-on-one bishop interviews are conducted. In the year 2018, we heard about they were one-on-one interviews with people and often had questions of a sexual nature, and some of that was changed, right?
Yes. They, first of all, the church changed. This is after quite a bit of pressure that was put upon the church to end these one-on-one interviews. So now they unveiled a new policy just before, I think, the April conference that would allow youth children to have another adult with them in this interview. These are called sometimes worthiness interviews, and it does sometimes talk about the law of chastity and questions of sexual nature, I think are often asked by, or at least frequently enough that they make headlines by bishops that the church sort of discourages, but still happens. And so one prominent member of the church, a former bishop, took this on as a cause. Became very vocal in his opposition. Sam Young ended up getting excommunicated from the church. He's still pushing that cause. So those were altered. We'll have to see in practice how it actually works.
Right, and he's pushing for even greater reform than,
exactly,
than has taken place.
Yeah, he thinks these interviews should be done away with, essentially, yes.
It's interesting. You know, this whole hour I have been issuing calls to listeners to call in with their pick for, underplayed stories of the year. And I've got Bernadette, who's calling in from Rockville, who's on the phone and has a pick for underplayed story of the year. What have you got for your choice, Bernadette?
So it kind of was a surprise to me, but our Potempe Hot Springs down here, the Virgin River, right, that separates Leverkin and Hurricane.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden we heard that there was a potential reopening of the Hot Springs as a resort. A few years ago, there was a legal battle and bankruptcy, and the owners, I think, had no idea how much political clout the Washington County Water Conservancy District had. Hmm. So it was kind of an ugly situation. But now there's light, and there's talk of preliminary possibly reopening the hot springs to the public, which would be a real blessing for so many of us.
Thank you very much. An interesting pick for underplayed story of the week.
You live in a desert. The people control the water, control the power. So it's, they call the shots down there.
Certainly is underplayed. I can't remember us writing a story about it.
No, so. I haven't heard it either. Yeah. And thanks, Bernadette, for your call. And
like the story tip.
Again, 801-355-8255 is the number to call to add your voice to this conversation, underplayed story of the year, or the story that defined 2018, maybe. Give us a call and let us know. 801-355-TALK. David Noyce, in your compilation of the year's news that you put together, which you can find at sltrib.com, you describe the fact that Utah saw a housing crisis, an affordable housing crisis in particular, in the state. Can you describe the sort of logistics of that, the numbers behind that?
You know, we see tons of construction going on, especially in the Salt Lake Valley. We see these cranes everywhere building unit housing. And so it seems like there shouldn't be a housing crisis when you see all this construction. But it's not affordable, one of the problems. And even though there's this, it's certainly not a glut. The vacancy rates have never been lower. Mm. For say apartments, and it's getting harder for people trying to buy single family homes too. They might be able to sell their home, but they can't find the home that they want to move into. So it's this recurring problem. Matter of fact, some websites have identified Salt Lake City as one of like 7 or 8 or 9 cities that's headed for a housing bubble burst.
What about all of the construction that's been going? I mean, isn't that doing anything to help this crisis at all?
The hard part is a lot of that is higher end apartments. These are expensive. This is, one bedroom for $1,500, $2,000. And the idea is that we've had a lot of jobs move here. For the tech center in, the Lehigh area, Draper, you had Goldman Sachs brought in a lot of people. We have young people who are, moving into the state with some money. Those are where a lot of the building has gone. It's hard for a developer to want to build affordable housing when they can build high-end housing and make more money.
Right.
So we see a lot of building going on in the state, but you got to realize we're growing. In the last decade, we added 400,000 people. They have to live somewhere. And
Matt Canham is giving us the breakdown here. What about high density developments that we see residents often rejecting them in their neighborhoods?
Yeah, and I think that when we put in tracks and light rail on this, the idea was to build high density around that. And that is what's happening, and everyone's kind of okay with it. That was the plan. But if you live in Harriman, where Olympia Hills was supposed to be built, a high-density community, that doesn't feel as fun. If you're on Holiday and you look at the old Cottonwood Mall site and know that that's going to be apartment towers, you're not as excited about it.
Right.
And we've seen communities really come up in arms. In Holiday, they voted it down, got it on the ballot, and rejected it. In Harriman, they pushed so hard that the mayor vetoed it and starting over.
County Mayor Ben McAdams.
Yeah.
Robert Gerke, the part of this sounds like it's an aesthetics question too. You have people who say, I'm fine with the idea of density in housing. I just don't like the way it looks where you're going to put it, right across the street from my house.
Right. Nobody wants it in their neighborhood because they want to be able to afford a single family home with a big yard and a nice place and not have to worry about other people moving in there. And it just doesn't work. I mean, at some point, something's got to give. We've got a population that's growing 50% faster than the housing units available. There are projections that within the next 20 years, the average home price in Utah could be $1.3 million, which is sort of mind-boggling to think of. And you worry about the next generation. Are my kids going to be able to afford a home when they decide they want to settle down with a family? Something's got to give here. The Salt Lake Chamber's gotten involved in trying to promote some affordable housing in the state. But on the trajectory we're on with the growth that we've seen and the opposition to housing density that we've seen, it's untenable. The other problem with people that oppose housing density is if you just go with these single family homes, it just feeds sprawl and that feeds traffic and that feeds air pollution. And so it's not a good quality of life for these people to oppose housing density in their neighborhood. Something's going to have to give or else we're on a trajectory we can't sustain.
Okay. I'm just going to quickly circle back to a story we were talking about earlier, and it was Laura McCluskey, I guess is the pronunciation. There was a caller who called and didn't remain on the line, but who said that this was the year of women getting thrown under the bus and wanted that comment put out there. And I don't know. We had the Kavanaugh hearings that saw a lot of people getting frustrated about accusations not being believed. I don't know.
I don't know if I'd say the year of women being thrown under the bus. There were some high-profile negative stories, but it's also the year of the Me Too movement, where women came forward with stories of sexual harassment and assault that were taken seriously in a variety of levels. That I think that there was some progress made in taking women seriously when they say something bad happened to them. But there's clearly way, way more that needs to be done.
Although I think you mentioned the Kavanaugh hearing. I think that was a low point, and I think maybe that's what the caller's referring to. And Senator Hatch and Senator Lee had played prominent roles in sort of that embarrassing scenario.
I'm so sorry that we have to do this, but it's already time for our last segment of the show. And for this segment, I'd like to turn for our picks for underplayed story of the year. And then beyond that, I'd like for each of you, if you don't mind, to offer a prediction about the stories to look out for in 2019. And of course, you could tie those two things together. Matt Canham, do you care to get us started?
I'd love to, so they don't steal my idea. I'm going to go with one story that kind of fits both of what you said, and it'd be the Inland Port. The legislature made this idea or this commission that's going to push forward this huge shipping hub out near the airport, near the Great Salt Lake, that's supposed to be the biggest economic project this state has ever seen. And they did it by commandeering control of a huge swath of Salt Lake City. So I think that process is just getting started. It will be pushed forward quite a bit in the next year. And it will also come as the Salt Lake City mayor is up for election. Multiple people have already said they're going to run against Mayor Jackie Biskupski, and I think the Inland Port will be a big issue in that race.
All right, Matt Canham's pick about the Inland Port. David Noyce, how about yours? Your pick for underplayed story of 2018.
I almost think this is the underplayed story virtually every year, and that's climate change. Continues to. I think I told Stoll Roberts. Continues to haunt the planet essentially. Yeah. Locally, Brian Maffley did a story recently about juniper trees dying in southeastern Utah. Now, junipers are a drought-resistant tree. They're supposed to exist and beyond through droughts. but they're dying. And scientists are just now starting to look at why is that happening? And it could be that we've just reached a breaking point that, you know, that even junipers can't exist in that. And, you know, we saw the effects of it again, and certainly California did with the fires. Those devastating fires are just going to continue and get worse. And that's, I think, almost always constantly underplayed.
Okay.
I'm going to shift gears. If you want me to look to 2019,
yeah.
Look for more changes. Within the LDS Church. Sister missionaries can wear pants now, so almost anything's possible. Perhaps the most revealing interview of the year was given by Russell Nelson's wife, where she said, "It is though he's been unleashed. He's finally free to do what he came on earth to do. He's free to follow through with things he's been concerned about but could never do. Now he's president of the church. He can do those things."
Wow.
So
unleashed.
I think he will continue to do, that's the word she used. And President Nelson said himself, wait till next year, and then the next year, eat your vitamin pills, get your rest. It's going to be exciting.
It's going to be exciting. All right, interesting picks for both Underplayed Story of the Year and the future. Robert Gerke, how about for your choice? I mean, it was going to be climate change.
Dave stole mine on climate change, and I think one of the issues relating to climate change that he mentioned, Brian's done a great job covering it, but it affects our ski industry, it affects our air quality, and these growth issues drive it. I will say that I think one of the underplayed stories this year was our lack of an enforceable hate crimes law. There was this gruesome attack on a young man who was working at his father's tire shop, or uncle's tire shop, I guess,
yeah.
And he was beaten by somebody who said he was there to kill a Mexican. And we don't have a law in the books that it makes that a hate crime, and we're one of the few states that doesn't. It's been killed every year in the legislature that it's been brought up, and you know, maybe this is going to be the year that we have it. I would, if I have to turn to 2019 and predict, I think it probably won't. I think they're going to kill it again. And I think my other prediction for 2019 is that we'll see Mayor Jim DeBacus as the next mayor of Salt Lake.
Wow, predictions, big predictions. Woo! From Robert Gerke. You know, I will just reiterate Brian Maffley and his reporting. There was a story that he did on dust from the drying Great Salt Lake and how much that's affecting our snow impact and potential to impact the ski industry. Check that out as a story to watch in 2019. Matt Canham, David Noyce, and Robert Gerke, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for being here today.
Thanks
a lot.
And Happy New Year. Listeners, this show is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts at our website, kcpw.org. Have a great new year. We'll see you again next week.